Hi everyone, I'm Greg from Pilot Institute. We train drone pilots all over the country.
Hi, my name is Haya from Drone Excel, where we cover all the drone news on our website.
Welcome to the latest episode of the Pixel Drone Show, our weekly podcast where we talk to industry professionals about what they do in the UAS space.
From professionals who use drone to fly inspection missions to public safety users or even drone light shows, you will learn on the Pixel Drone Show that drones are much more than just toys.
Well, folks, this is a special edition today of the Pixel Drone Show. It's just Haya and I, and we are in person.
Yeah, for the first time ever. I mean, everything so far, we've done, what, 70?
70 shows.
About 70 Pixel shows, and this is the first time we're doing it real life here in the studio, which, I'll be honest, is pretty impressive.
Awesome. Yeah, yeah. Well, so Haya, we just came back from Airworks in Vegas and decided to drive back together and then spend a couple days here in Prescott talking about Pixel, talking about drones. And yep. Then we're going to sit down. We're just going to talk about Airworks and talk about things for a little while. No guests today. We are the guests. So we hope you enjoy this kind of different landscape, different everything. And then talk about Airworks, right?
Awesome. Let's get started. I think, so this is the first Airworks after the whole COVID. We had, one that was purely online.
Yep.
The first one was in San Francisco. I wasn't there. I've been to the other ones in Dallas and in LA. I thought it was amazing to be able to be back in person, talk to people face to face, and I don't think you can get that same experience when it's only online. So it was good to see everybody again and to catch up. And I don't know what you thought, but
I agree. I think this was interesting because I've been to a lot recently of big conferences. You know, Commercial UAV Expo. We did, I wasn't at AUVSI, but I was at the previous one before that. And this is a smaller show, which is understandable too, because it's DJI only.
Yeah.
So you see people that are, you know, working for DJI, that are creating things for the DJI ecosystem. I want to actually get started before we talk about the dock. I want to talk about the discussion that we had there, where we talked about companies that are trying to take down DJI and the effect that this would have. And it kind of dawned on me when you and I were talking about this, how bad actually, imagine how many people you would put out of business and pretty much take a good portion of the whole industry by getting rid of DJI.
Yeah, so this DJI Airworks, I think there were like roughly 600 people, which I believe is less, and it was smaller for sure than the previous live one in Los Angeles. And then the one prior to that was the one in Dallas, I think. They were significantly bigger, maybe even twice as big. All of the companies that are represented at DJI Airworks basically built on the DJI platform and ecosystem. And since DJI has been under fire so much politically over the last couple of years, if let's say in some extreme scenario, DJI would no longer be able to operate in the United States, all those companies would be in a tough situation because they're building their business on top of the DJI business, basically.
Yep.
And we were talking about that during the show, and it's like, you're kind of dependent on DJI still being around.
Well, and then resellers, right? There are a lot of resellers out there.
Yeah.
And then obviously all the customers that are using DJI. Now, if you know this goes out, some people out there can switch probably to Autel, but a lot of other companies have needs that just don't exist outside of DJI. Yeah. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thought, like the effect that this would have. And probably the companies that are trying to go after DJI would be also hurting themselves because they wouldn't necessarily get those sales afterwards because they don't have the product to go with it. So I think it would just hurt the industry in general.
But this is already a bad situation, right? I mean, the worst scenario would be that DJI gets kicked out of the US market. That would be disastrous, I think. But even the current situation with all the uncertainty and all the questions and the continuous like attacks, basically, I think already is a pretty bad situation.
Yep, I agree. So cool things that we saw. First day we get there and they were testing this thing outside. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, DJI Dock.
DJI Dock.
DJI Dock is a box, drone in a box. Box opens up, so the drone is weather protected, charges, basically sits there ready to fly. The box would open up and the drone flies and does its job. I think ideally that would be for the kind of missions that you would do frequently. So if you're, let's say, monitoring a construction site, or you're monitoring inventory, let's say in a mining situation, you could have that drone fly, let's say, twice a day or once a week or whatever you need. And in scenarios like that, a drone in the box concept would make a lot of sense. And Greg can tell you all about this, there are a number of restrictions in terms of drone regulations and whether drone regulations currently allow missions like that, and they don't.
No, not in the US at least. And so these designs are designed worldwide. Obviously, DJI is a worldwide company. There's a lot of other companies that are also doing boxes. I was actually surprised, talked to one of the company, and he said, our software will go into 11 different drone in a box. And I was like, I had no idea that there were actually 11 drones in the box out there.
Wow.
Yeah, that do this. And that just kind of something that I had no idea. So I'm going to research some more of these and kind of see what they do. But the drone in the box concept is interesting. Like you say, hard right now with the regulation, the way that it is. But they gave us a demo. So there's a Matrice 30 inside of this box. And it's all hooked up. It's all secure in there. There's a little weather station sitting on top of the platform that, you know, allows the drone to decide whether or not it should take off. And then there's a little camera as well to see what's going on so they can get a status of the drone. It kind of opens up. It's really cool. I'm sure we'll have footage that you can look at. And then the drone eventually just takes off. Now, Vegas is Vegas, right? It's one, it's difficult to fly. Two, there's a ton of tall building all around with all the different hotels and everything. And of course, the location that we're in is kind of in the middle of all this. So they had a bit of issue with the RTK module that's attached to the drone. They weren't able to get a really good location. Now, obviously, these boxes are not going to be set up in there. If anything, if they were set up, let's say in Vegas, they would be set up on top of a tall building. Yeah. And at that point, you have the ability to just take off whenever you want because you have full signal. So they had a bit of difficulty, which I feel bad for them because, you know, this is... This is their grand show, right? They're releasing. This is the first time we see it in the US.
Yeah.
Right? And and then they weren't able to take off. They weren't able to land at one point, but we did get a full demo. I thought it was really cool. For me, I'm a hardware geek, so I'm going and looking at the details of how they do this. Yeah. The drone lands. It doesn't land perfectly, obviously, in the exact spot, but they need to recharge the drone. And the way they're going to recharge the drone is by using that slides. So first it kind of recenters the drone in this perspective right here, and then it comes in, and the landing gear has two little dots where you can, the plug goes in. It comes in, it kind of squeezes it, and then starts charging. And I thought that was just a brilliant design. And then it opens up, the thing goes, and then it just takes off. So we did, speaking of that, we did watch a presentation from BNSF that was kind of showing how they were using that drone in the box. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah. So if you think about the kind of missions where something like this would make sense, I mean, let's say Chula Vista Police Department, they could have a drone in a box on the rooftop of a police station. And then let's say a 911 call comes in and the drone would fly directly to that spot and monitor the situation and would get there most likely before any police officer shows up. So that will be one way to use it. In this case, we're talking about a train company, and they have massive lots of carts, basically, or trains. And on average, they lose them as well. So they about 10 a day, I think he mentioned. So they sometimes need to find the right train cart or wagon, whatever you call that.
Yep.
Either way, they then fly out the drone, and as the drone is recording all the footage, they use AI to look for the names and the numbers to find the right vehicle that they're looking for. In the old days, you'd send out a guy in a car, and sometimes they drive around for 4 or 5 hours trying to find this one train section. Whereas now with the drone, it's basically, at least from a technical point of view, you can do this fully automatically. So you don't need any human interference at all, basically. The problem, and this is where you run into the drone regulations, currently you need a pilot in command and you can't fly beyond visual line of sight. Whereas the drone in the box concept is ideal for fully automated missions, and the drones are very much capable of flying beyond visual line of sight.
Yep.
So all kinds of inspections, inventory monitoring, construction site monitoring are all kind of scenarios where you could use a drone like this. The technology is there. This was not the ideal setup for a demonstration, but you can see that it would work if the circumstances were better. The technology is there. The regulations, as always, need to catch up and allow us or enable us to be able to use drones in this way. And I think we'll get there, but
It's going
to
take time.
Yeah, it's going to take some time.
It's going to take time. Now, they had a cool user interface too. Did you get to see the user interface on the screen? I know you were taking a lot of videos of the thing taking off and landing. So what the user interface itself would show you essentially the location of the drone on a 3D map, but also show you the feed, live feed from the drone. And then, like I said, a lot of companies now can actually plug in into that data and then create their own software on the side in order to analyze the data, which I thought this was cool. So this is another company that we talked to that was doing analysis of the actual data using AI. And they had a little booth set up, and they had a camera there that would detect a human. So you were walking by, and it would do a box around the person, and it said human. And then there was one, I looked at it for a little while, and there was somebody wearing a tie. And it walked by, and there was a square that said tie on the person.
Using AI.
Using AI to detect it as he was walking. So the little thing would follow him as he was walking and just said tie. And then there was a chair on the thing. So when somebody would go in front of the chair, it would disappear. But then there was a label that said chair. Yeah. So I talked to the guy, and I said, can you do this for anything? He said, yeah, we can teach the AI to recognize anything. Yeah. So eventually you can think of like a search and rescue environment where you'd send a drone like this in a box. You have them in the middle of the mountains in different places, right? And then this thing basically just sends the drone, goes and look for someone, finds it, sends the location back without even a user input.
The first time I came across a story like this, where they would use a drone with AI in a situation like Greg is describing, is the company, I think they're called Little Ripper in Australia, and they would use drones to fly along the beaches and basically look and see what's in the water, and then they use AI to identify a swimmer or a kid on a bodyboard or somebody surfing. But the whole purpose was to be able to identify sharks and to make sure that there's a warning system so that if there's a shark in the vicinity, you can get the people out of the water in time and make sure that everybody's safe. What I found really impressive is that not only were they able to distinguish between swimmers and sharks, but they can even tell the difference between a shark and a dolphin. And if you train the AI enough, so you basically label, let's say, 1,000 photos of sharks swimming in the ocean, and then you label them and you tag also, let's say, 1,000 photos of a dolphin, the AI system is able to distinguish between those two animals. And that was the first use case I saw where it makes a lot of sense. But of course, there are many other situations where drone technology in combination with AI can be super beneficial.
Yeah, no, I agree. And then while we were outside, we saw friends from Skybras doing a demo of their Skybras. I always love to see the Skybras demo because Jeff goes in there and he said, well, I got a half hour, but the software really takes a minute and a half and it's only one button. So I don't know what we're going to talk about. So they do the whole demo, which is amazing because this thing will do a reconstruction, right, in a minute and a half flight with a video. And then they're able to send all that data and create a 3D model that's extremely precise. And they can do this. The actual building of the model takes 10-15 minutes. And then they're basically done after that.
Yeah, and I think the big benefit that Skybras offers is that normally if you do photogrammetry, you would take all these photos and then you need to stitch them together, make that model. And the processing of all that takes a lot of time. So you fly a mission in the morning, and if you have the model ready in the afternoon, you're doing a really good job. Skybras takes it to a different level. They take video footage instead of photos and take the images, the frames from the video, build the model, and their model is ready to go in what, minutes?
Yeah, 12. I think it takes 12 to 15 minutes.
So you go get a cup of coffee, you come back, your model is ready. And especially in situations where time is of the essence, so let's say there's a building on fire or there is a car crash on the highway, you want to be able to open up the highway quickly, but you first need to map out the scene of the accident using their technology, that can be done super, super fast. So you can imagine all the time savings that are a result of that. And in case of a fire, if you're better able to deploy your resources, now we're talking about saving people's lives. So that stuff is super impressive.
And they're also, they've been working on an indoor component. Jeff from Skybras was here when they started talking about this, and they mapped our interior here with their beta model. They would just built this whole thing in here. We flew a drone inside here for a few minutes and then were able to get a full 3D. So now they're going to use this to do a lot of different things, especially inside of schools. So to help police departments get inside of schools in case they need to, and obviously fire departments as well, in case there is a fire, then they would have the school area mapped and then have the ability to provide that information. So I think that's really cool.
Didn't they team up recently with Paladin?
Yes, they're also working with Paladin. Yeah. So yeah, lots of stuff going on. I'm kind of going through my my pictures that I took at the show, so we can kind of see what we missed. Obviously, we met with our friends Ken, Billy were out there, Jared. So our guest instructors that do things with us on a regular basis, had a good time with them, walking around and kind of talking to different people. We had what was another company that kind of caught your attention?
Oh, the company. So there's one company. Think about search and rescue scenario. So somebody goes out hiking in the Rockies and gets lost and is in a tough spot and afraid that he or she might not make it back home in time and needs to be found. Of course, you can send out a drone, which already is better than, let's say, sending volunteers out on foot and trying to find somebody, because with the drone you can scan an area much faster. Take it up another level, you'd have a drone with a thermal camera, so now you can look for heat signatures and find that person even quicker. The company that we saw was arguably even better, I think, because what they do is they have a device mounted underneath the drone that basically looks for cell phone signals. So if you're in a remote area, your cell phone, assuming it still has battery, will always look and try to connect to a cell tower, even if there's no cell tower around. This drone basically is a flying cell tower. So it looks for that signal, and then it flies around in a big square area. So it takes measurements from different locations and is able to pinpoint where that person is. So even if that person is unconscious or whatever the situation might be, as long as that cell phone is still active, they can actually pinpoint and locate that person. I thought that was a super innovative way of using drones and this kind of technology. I'd never heard about it. We spoke with, I believe, was the founder of that company.
Yep.
They're out of Spain. I'll look up the name in a second, but that's the cool thing of going to expos like this, is you run into people that come up with yet another new way that we can use drone technology. And I'm still blown away, even after writing this many stories for Drone Excel, that you can still run into new ways that people use drones.
And we talked to Russ, who's used that technology before in actual response scenarios. And he just told us how mind blowing it is.
Yeah.
So I was interested in the back end of it, like how are they able to actually pinpoint a certain phone? And you might be wondering, like, you know, do you put the cell phone number in there and then they can go find it? It's a bit more complicated. They need to find, it's an MIME number, I think, that comes from you. It's the SIM card number, basically. It's not a cell phone number, which is not available to anyone. So you can't just put in a cell phone number and then find the person. But they would have to go through some channels in order to find that information from the carrier. But I thought this, and he told us, Russ said, basically, you can find the person almost right away. In that situation, as long as the cell phone is on. But think about it, I mean, how many people have their cell phone turned on when they go?
That's cool. We spoke to Kyle Nordfors from Weber County in Utah, I believe. He introduced a drone program starting in 2018 in their local search and rescue organization. And we were talking with him about, first of all, the benefit of drones when you're trying to find missing people, then drones with thermal cameras, and then technology like this. And for them, and he's like a huge proponent of drones for search and rescue
missions. Former guest, we had him on the show.
We had him on the Pixel show. Yep. I've run into him plenty of times at conventions. And especially for search and rescue, drones are a game changer. Totally.
Yeah. And then we saw a lot of different payloads. Walked around looking at this giant speaker that, remember, this giant speaker from a Matrice 300. You put this underneath the Matrice 300, it replaced all the other payload. It does have a little camera inside so you can see what's going on, but it just projects from an amazing distance. I saw it in demo. We didn't say a demo this time, but I saw a demo when I was in Oregon at the LIDA conference, and this thing was 2,500 feet away playing music, and you could still hear the music from 25. And there was like a road right there with traffic going on, and we could still hear the music. That was kind of, it's always an impressive one. I don't know that anybody uses that, but I thought it was just
I know of one use case. So in this case, you have a speaker mounted on the drone, but that same company also has a microphone mounted on the drone. So now there's two-way communication. A couple of years ago in a earthquake scenario, I believe it was in Japan, they actually flew drones over all the rubble and the buildings that collapsed. And if you think about it, I mean, in those collapsed buildings, there might be people that are stuck inside still and still alive. However, many times it's not safe to venture out there. Like there might still be buildings that can collapse even more. So in order to locate those people, what they did in Japan is they flew a drone with a microphone over that area to pick up the sounds from people that were basically asking for help. And so again, it's a way that a drone creates a solution where you don't have to put somebody's lives in danger to walk through all that rubble. You can first find the victim, and then once you know where they are, you can then find a way to get to them in a safe manner.
And save a life.
Yeah, exactly. So again, it's like a new way of using drones with technology that now exists. And I think it's awesome to be able to talk to those people. And again, at a trade show, you can actually talk to them in person and get those conversations and stories.
Yep. We talked to the DJI Flywire people too, that they have, and it's not a DJI brand, it's Flywire. They do parachutes for DJI. Small parachute, large parachutes. They were outside testing that. The Mentee, you may have seen some of the videos that we did on the Mentee. Those are videos for the smaller parachutes, for the smaller drones that you can put on. They were outside doing a demo on how we were excited. We went outside. We thought they were going to fire up a drone and use the parachute. They didn't. They were just showing how to put it on, which I thought was cool. And then we talked to them about the way that it releases. So we had a guest. I think it's gone live by now, by the time we publish this, that we talked to you about parachute systems, and then the system to deploy the parachute, they were using springs and they were using rubber bands, right? Yeah. And then this company here, the Mentee, is a pyrotechnic device that fires up, which you have to replace, unfortunately, which makes it just a pain in the butt, quite frankly, to use over time. So it's interesting. We had a discussion too with some industry members about the parachutes and if we thought that parachutes were going to be something that's needed for Category 2 and Category 3 drone. Yeah. Right? We haven't seen Category 2 and Category 3 drone, even though it's been in regulation since 2020.
Yeah.
The holdup to me, I think, is there's not enough demand out there of people that would want to buy these kind of drones compared to the R&D that it would take to make it happen.
One of the parachute companies, I think, is no longer around, right?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. So I think I know at least of four of them, one of which is, I don't think they're active anymore. Maybe they're looking to sell their business. I don't know if there's enough of a business case there. I mean, if there would be, I kind of would expect DJI to come with a in-house solution for those kind of scenarios as well. But who knows?
It's also that these companies are building... A lot of these companies are building drones for the world. This is a US requirement. In Europe, there's a different requirement, right? Yeah. We were talking to a guy that said over there, they have to have a parachute to pretty much fly anywhere they wanted, close to an airport, close to whatever it was. So yeah, with all these different types of regulation, the remote ID is going to be the same thing, right? Remote ID, different regulation. Japan has remote ID. Europe has remote ID. The US has remote ID, but it's all different. And so, you know, when you're a large company that does worldwide stuff, what do you focus on? And if the market isn't big enough...
Do you think we ever will get to a point where drone regulations are the same in different countries?
Nope.
No.
I mean, we're not there with airplane, and it's been going on for 70 years, right? 80, probably 100 years.
Yeah.
Now, I think, and it's too sad, because when you learn to fly an aircraft, you should learn to fly an aircraft, and that's it. The regulation should follow pretty much everywhere the same, but I think it's too complicated at this stage. I mean, Europe allows people to fly there with an American license, so an airline pilot has an FAA license, and they go fly in Europe, and they're okay.
That's recognized
It's recognized. Now, a private pilot can go and fly in Europe, get an equivalency license, but then when you get to the commercial level, if you wanted to live in Europe and fly in Europe and you did all your training in the US, you have to get the European license, and it just doesn't work. Now, drones were not there. It's also a piecemeal. Every single country has different rules, different things. Europe is even trying to do each country to have the same rules, but even within that, they have special rules for each country. So,
which is, in a way, it's almost weird, right? Because a lot of the drone models are exactly the same.
All across.
So you can fly the same drone in the US and in Europe.
Yep.
The use cases and the missions that you fly are oftentimes very similar. So all that is kind of the same, but then the rules are different.
Yep.
So now your drone needs to be slightly different. And you don't have the, let's say, 6 mile radius or range that you have with a Mavic here in the US. Now you're limited to too much less in Europe. So Maybe the drone industry can do a better job and kind of get everybody on the same page.
I think each industry, each country is kind of on their own right now. I try to read stuff about what happens in Europe, but yeah. It's just so much to keep track as it is in the US that if you add on, you know, trying to keep track of everything that goes on in Europe, it's difficult. And I don't fly there. I mean, I know I grew up there, but I don't fly there. So it's less of an interest for me for sure. But yeah, well,
one of the other cool stories from DJI Airworks is one morning I'm in the elevator and I hadn't had my coffee yet. So I'm like half awake, let's say. And somebody else walks in, of course, he's got a DJI Airworks badge as well. And so do I. So it's like, hey, how are you? Good morning. And he recognized my accent. I'm from the Netherlands. So I'm Dutch. And he's like, are you from Holland? All these three names are for the same country, by the way. It's confusing. He's like, are you from Holland? I'm like, yeah, I am. So we switched back into Dutch, which is the language. Turns out that we're both from the same country. He was actually going to do one of the keynotes. I think it was the last morning. His name is Bart Knowles, and he's involved in fighting malaria and effectively fighting mosquitoes in the Maldives. And the Maldives is a group of islands in the Indian Ocean. It's very low. I think the highest point he told me is about 6-7 feet above sea level. And malaria is a huge problem there. And malaria is mostly dangerous for young kids. So anybody below the age of 5, malaria is legitimately dangerous and could end your life. Now, they're using drones to fight the mosquitoes. And what they're doing is they have a non-chemical substance. And I forgot the name. It's not an easy name to remember. But they spray the wetlands and areas where there's water. And what it does is that film of that layer on top of the surface of water prevents the mosquito larvae to breathe. So basically they're drowning. Mm-hmm. And as a result, you get rid of all the mosquitoes. Now, the thing that kind of blew them away is that even 8 weeks later, there are hardly any mosquitoes in those areas. So areas that are heavily infested by mosquitoes, you can basically clear it. And if you run, let's say, a drone mission, drone in a box, every month you kind of spray that area, you can keep it mosquito free. And mosquitoes, believe it or not, is the largest, how do you call that? Most people per year, if they die because of, let's say, wildlife
fatality.
Or insects, yeah, it's mosquitoes. So to be able to use drones in a safe way and tackle this problem is a huge deal.
Could save thousands, millions of lives, probably.
Yeah, so he had a super interesting presentation, and we're getting him on the Pixel Drone Show. So hopefully within a couple of weeks, we can get him on the show and you'll be able to hear his story. And again, it's one of those situations where they're using drones in ways that many people had never thought of. DJI got really excited because they send them in a T-30 for free. Then they send in a whole film crew to kind of document how they were using drones and the results that they got. And yeah, it was I thought it was one of the more interesting keynotes actually during Airworks.
Yeah, that's, I mean, when you have applications like that, that could change the lives of hundreds of millions of people. Well, maybe not hundreds, but millions of people possibly.
It's huge.
That's crazy. That's amazing. Well, you did the perfect transition, which is the Agras. You get into this conference, there's this massive, massive drone sitting right there in the middle, and you walk next to it and it's just massive, right? The propellers are this long of DJI Agras, that's the agriculture thing. There's quite a bit of presentations, I thought, on agriculture. This is not something that we hear a whole lot of. I think it's being used quite a bit, but everybody's kind of just doing it and not really talking about it.
Well, isn't part of the problem that these drones are over the max weight limit for drones and therefore they don't fit within the current drone regulations?
There is a lot of regulations behind it. There is obviously operating a drone, obviously it's large, so you need to be registering it differently and then have a pilot license in order to do it.
Yeah.
A crewed aircraft license. And then Part 137, which is all the stuff to carry pesticides inside of these aircraft. So it is heavy, the application is complicated, and I think it's a major barrier to entry for a lot of people.
Those drones are huge. They're like at least this big. It's an aircraft. Like, it's not just your average DJI Mavic. Mm-hmm. The T-40 represents the capacity of the tank that they use for pesticides. So it fits 40 liters, which would, let's say, be around 80 pounds. So that's just the liquid. Then you get the weight of the drone. So it's a legitimate drone. Mm-hmm. the drone, which I thought was fascinating, it maps the area that it's going to fly over. Mm-hmm. And so if you fly that same mission again, so if it's a rice paddy, it's easy because it's all flat. But let's say if you're flying over fruit trees and it's a hill, then that drone would map the area and know exactly how high it needs to fly over the treetops to be most effective with its spraying, but then raise as the elevation increases. And yeah, again, kind of, you could do a drone in the box concept there as well, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And then have that mission repeat itself. I don't know if they need to do it weekly or monthly or however frequently they fly. Mm-hmm. But it's a way to use drones. And I think the woman from DJI who was presenting this drone shared how the agricultural business for DJI has just taken off in the last 4 or 5 years.
And that's a cheap drone. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, what did it tell us? 20 grand?
26,000.
26,000 for this large drone. Obviously, there's a lot of paperwork, like I said, that goes into this. The interest for me is, over time I've developed allergies to to wheat and other things that I never had before in my life. And after doing some research, it turns out that a lot of this is related to having a lot of pesticides on the food. Because we are destroying, in a way, kind of the whole ecosystem by just having so much pesticide. So you hear people that get allergic to wheat and other blends. That's really what it comes from in a lot of cases. And so for me, if they have the ability to use less pesticide but use it more centralized on areas that actually need it, because right now for agriculture, they just spray everything in the hope that it takes care of everything, but maybe not everything needs to be sprayed, just these areas. And it would be a lot cheaper for them as well over the long run. So I'm excited about that part and being able to actually eat something without getting allergies.
Yeah, and it's not just the spraying, because and this was a couple of years ago, also DJI Airworks, when they introduced the Phantom 4 multispectrum.
Yep.
I think it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they had a use case for agriculture there as well, where they fly the drone over the cornfield, for instance, and they're able to identify the parts of the field that are doing really well, parts that are too wet, parts that are too dry, and they can basically analyze the performance of the plants, if you will, and then figure out what sections of that field need to be treated in what way. Mm-hmm. So even before you would fly a drone with pesticides out there, rather than, let's say, spraying the entire field, you can apply that only where it's necessary. Mm-hmm. So as a result, you get a better return from your crop or from your farm or your field or what have you.
Mm-hmm. Better yield.
And again, it's a way that helicopters wouldn't really be able. I mean, you can spray with airplanes and I guess with helicopters, but all that stuff is a lot more expensive than getting a drone that
and
can
not,
do the
not
work
as
for
precisely
you.
Too, obviously.
Yeah.
Not as precisely. No, we saw the Mavic 3. I thought this is getting interesting, the whole Mavic 3 ecosystem. Obviously, DJI released the Mavic 3 and Mavic 3 Cine at first, and I don't think we ever knew how big that platform was going to become.
Yeah.
This is the new Phantom 4 platform, right? You and I talked about this in the car. DJI is rolling into getting rid of the Phantom platform completely. I think this is clear by now. They came up with the Mavic 3, Mavic 3 Cine, and then now we're starting to see the Mavic 3 Enterprise obviously popped up, and then possibly even Mavic 3 Classic. You kind of reported on that, which would be a much lower price point. Now, do you think this is going to make quite a few people angry with DJI,
I think
Mavic 3 Classic?
I mean, we don't know the official specs yet, so we can't really compare exactly with certainty. However, word on the street is that basically the DJI Mavic 3 Classic is the exact same as the regular DJI Mavic 3, minus the telelens. So you get the same range, same battery life, same performance, same Micro Four Thirds camera, the main camera, but you lose the telelens. Now, depending on how you use drones, I mean, let's say if you're a police officer, you're flying drones, maybe the ability to zoom in and like look and see what's going on from a distance means a lot to you. However, if you're more into, let's say, shooting drone videos or taking photos, then maybe you don't even care about the telelens because the quality wasn't right there to begin with anyway. So maybe the main lens is a lot more important. If you're one of those people, then getting the Mavic 3 Classic would make a lot of sense, and you'd probably save, what, $600-$700? Which
Because it's
a lot of money.
$3,000, I think, was the... Well, I guess you can buy the drone without the controller, right?
Well, forget about the controller for a second. But I mean, if you buy the standard Mavic 3 for around $2,000, and we don't know the official price for the Mavic 3 Classic yet, but it's rumored to be around $1,400. So let's say you save about $600. Mm-hmm. To me, it seems what DJI has done is they launched the drone last year. Initially, they target people that really needs that drone or really badly want one and are willing to pay the extra money, get the drone. So the focus is kind of on the margin per drone that you sell. A year into it, you've served all those customers, right? So now what do you do to boost your sales? Well, one way to do it is to make that same drone that already is in production, dress it down a little bit, make it a lot less expensive, and now sell it in quantity. And I think the first time DJI tried that was with the DJI Mavic Mini. Yep. And then right before the Mini 2 came out, they had the Mini SE. And it's kind of the same thing. It was a bit of a mix of the old Mavic Mini and the Mini 2.
But just cheaper to get
cheaper. And where do you find it? Costco, Walmart, Best Buy, selling it to the masses. And yeah, it's smart. I mean, if you want to maximize your profits and grow your business and pay for nice head offices.
Yeah, I think I think the people that bought the Mavic 3, not even the Cine, because I think the Cine has its own space. We bought the Cine for a reason because we use ProRes and we wanted to have that. But the people that bought the Mavic 3 could be pretty pissed because now they have nobody really asked for a second camera that zooms, quite frankly. No. I don't think I've ever seen when this drone was being dreamt of in people's head, people weren't saying, oh man, I wish I had a zoom camera.
Unless you're in the police department or the military.
They've covered that with the Enterprise.
Yeah, but you see now in the conflict between Russia and Ukraine, the Mavic 3 is awesome because from a very safe, or not safe distance, but from a distance, you can see what's going on and record things or find coordinates and pass those on. So again, it kind of depends on the use case, like how you use the drone determines what's valuable to you, I guess.
Yeah, so the Phantom 4 is like this workhorse that we hear from people all the time. Every guest that we talk to, they said, we've flown the Mavic, the Phantom 4, reliable, durable.
Yeah.
And so I wonder how that's going to change for them and using because the Mavic 3 is, it's a great drone. It's built strong, but it's not built like,
it's not like robust. A Phantom 4. No, it's way more fragile.
Yeah. Folding legs, right? Eventually. Yeah.
I mean, the Mavic beats the Phantom 4 at this point, I think, in pretty much all areas. The only part where I still see that people want to have a Phantom is the people from Oceans Unmanned that use drones on the ocean, because the Phantom, you can just hand grab it securely, both hands, get that drone. They told us what they used, receiver gloves from football, because they're super grippy, and they would just hand grab a Mavic, and then of course the glove protects your fingers. With the Phantom, you didn't have to do that. With the Phantom, I mean, I've seen people use Phantoms on sailboat races in like 25 miles an hour winds in the middle of the ocean. The boats go fast, they go up and down over the waves, and they just grab the Phantom. And it shows you how versatile that drone is. The downside, of course, of a Phantom is that if you want to travel and throw it in your backpack, you have one backpack for your drone and one backpack for all the other things you want to bring.
Yeah.
And with the Mavic, you can pretty much fit it all in the same bag. So
I'm sure we'll get the feedback over time. And the Phantom 4 is going to become really difficult to find going forward. It is already. Now, we were at the press conference, and I did ask a question because I know a lot of our students and viewers here on the show have been asking, which is about the SDK for the Mavic 3. And the answer that we got from Adam was, well, if you want to fly missions for mapping, then just buy the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And I thought that was I'm sure that was the corporate answer, one. So I don't blame him personally. But I think from a DJI perspective, it's really short-sighted. The P4P, let's think about the price. P4P was what, $1,700?
Yeah.
What's Mavic 3 Enterprise?
I don't know exactly how much.
Yeah, it's a lot more than that.
It's
a lot more than that. So now you're forcing people that have been paying $1,700 for this drone that performed with a mechanical shutter. The only option you're giving them is basically getting a Mavic 3 Enterprise to design this.
However, whether something is expensive not only depends on the size of your wallet, but it also depends on like who are you talking to, right? I mean, expensive for me, yes. Expensive for, let's say, an oil company who's buying 100 of them, and they save millions with those drones.
Yep.
That drone is it doesn't matter. Like if it's 1,000 or 10,000, it's cheap to them. Yeah.
They've just gone, I think, from something that was affordable for the masses to something that is going to create barrier to entry for quite a few people if that's what you want to do, if you want to do it, if you want to do it well. So yeah, I don't know if I cared a lot for his answer and quite frankly, the way that he said it too, but it's short-sighted. Just make the thing available. Yeah. If people decide that it's good enough to do that, then let them decide that. Yeah. Don't restrict it with an SDK, especially when you have an SDK for the same exact platform. It's the same drone, right? It's a different payload.
Yeah.
So anyway,
they used to have a, he was the head of engineering, a French guy, worked out of California for DJI. He left 2 or 3 years ago. He did a presentation, I think that would have been in Dallas. So that's what, 4 years ago or something, 2018, I think, or 19. Doesn't matter. I mean, his presentation was about how DJI opened up their platform and introduced the SDK program, basically. And they didn't realize how that would take off. Mm-hmm. And they had a number of developers initially, the second year that had like grown tenfold. The next year it had basically exploded. And they didn't realize how many people from different businesses would be interested in being able to build additional tools, additional hardware, make it compatible with their software and their use cases and use drones again in ways that DJI had never thought of.
Yep.
And to me, it seems like that's the story from the drone industry. If you go back to the earlier days, let's say 2010, 11, 12, DJI develops the Phantom. At some point, they have a drone with a gimbal and a camera. And that was, I think, the big breakthrough. That it's basically, it's the complete package. You don't need to mess with GoPros anymore. Like you have the aircrafts ready to fly. And from that moment onwards, I think DJI has been playing catch up with all the ways in which people use drones. Like we've seen the most crazy use cases. Like one of the first ones I remember wasn't with a Phantom, was with an Inspire, where they put a Petri dish underneath the drone and they would fly over the ocean, try to catch the
snot?
Spray from whales. And they called it the snot bot because they would like scoop up a little bit of that spray, and that spray was enough to basically determine the health of the whale. So now all of a sudden, they had access to information about these whales that in the past they didn't have, or if they could get it, it was dangerous and not easy and definitely not affordable to get it. Mm-hmm. Now they're on a boat from a safe distance. They launch the drone, scoop it up, send it to a lab, and know
and they have it.
How those animals are doing. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of the story of the drone industry, is that all these use cases came about and the regulations are playing catch up, but even companies like DJI are playing catch up and trying to come up with different ways to accommodate it. And I think the SDK program has been a huge enabler for companies to come up with their own solutions and their own missions and to be able to use drones for that.
Yeah. You know, one thing that we didn't hear a whole lot about during the conference is discussions about the blacklisting, and I'm sure, obviously, that's by design, right?
You think so? Yeah. DJI's been under fire, since 2017, at least, I think.
Yeah, it feels like we've been talking about this yearly
forever. Yeah.
New changes recently with a new blacklisting, right?
Yeah, that's the most recent from the Department of Defense, blacklisting DJI, even going as far as to call the company I think they call it a military organization.
Chinese military company, yep.
Yeah, because the assumption is that the connection between the Chinese government and a number of Chinese businesses is so close that the US government is no longer comfortable working with them.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the ongoing story about DJI for the last couple of years. DJI at some point worked with the Department of the Interior, and I think they have, at the time, they had about 800 drones, and they would use them in like remote areas to count fish, to monitor forest growth. Like they would use it in areas that are not sensitive, and you could argue there's no sensitive data being collected. Like we're not flying around nuclear plants. This is out in the woods. DJI worked together with the Department of the Interior to come up with the Government Edition. And the Government Edition was a drone that was modified both with hardware and software to guarantee that whatever that drone was collecting in terms of GPS data, imagery, that it wouldn't leave the drone and that the Department of the Interior would be comfortable knowing that none of that information would go anywhere, let alone make its way to China, which is like the big fear that everybody has. So that would be the ideal drone, you would think. And even that wasn't good enough, because now we're at a point where you wonder what the future holds and whether DJI is going to be able to sell to government organizations.
Yeah, I don't think this is changing anytime soon.
No, it doesn't seem like it. Like, we went from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. Some people thought, okay, maybe that will change things. I don't think it has. It seems like we're still in the same struggle.
I mean, as a matter of fact, with the latest news, it's just continuing and getting worse. So,
yeah. And the real problem here is that there's not enough competition, right? I mean, DJI basically serves all of the drone markets, their share. I mean, there's different numbers out there, but let's say it's somewhere between 70 to 80, maybe even higher percentage. We need competition. We need another company to step up. And we've seen GoPro, and they failed miserably years ago. Now we've seen Sony, and you think, okay, Sony is consumer electronics. They got engineers, they got R&D, they got the money, they got the experience and the know-how, they have the logistics. If anybody can do it, it'd be Sony. And so far, the results with their first drone, the AirPeak S1 or whatever, that drone is okay-ish. It's not the home run.
We're not hearing a lot about it.
No, I mean, it's not the home run that you would want it to be.
No.
And then what else do you have? Like Autel Robotics? In theory, yes, they could be a drone, a DJI competitor. In reality, I don't think they are.
But not for the government.
Not for the government, because guess what? Made in China. What else you have? Unique?
Yep.
Are they still around?
They are. They are in Europe. It's interesting. Yeah. I see them at trade shows every once in a while. They seem like they have a good product. The drone looks good and everything, but you don't really hear much about it.
Are they relevant?
I don't know. I don't know. I've never really got a chance to fly one because you don't really hear about it. It's not available right there, you know?
So then one group that is interesting and does compete, but differently, they create their own little market, is the Blue SUS drones. Mm-hmm. Those are the drones that meets government regulations, and they're very strict. However, all the drones in that category, and there's about 10 of them now, I think, still contain parts that are made in China. So if the concern is China, then even Blue SUS doesn't really fix that issue.
But even when we talk to Blue UAS companies, they also tell us that it's a very niche market, right? Yeah. Obviously. So we're talking to a very specific customer. Mm-hmm. And past that, it doesn't really bring any more sales.
No.
It's just for that customer. So think about, as a company, do you want to put all of your R&D into this one drone that's for a fairly small customer?
Yeah.
When it doesn't really apply to the rest of the industry. I don't know that we have an easy solution at this stage for this industry. Obviously, you and I and everybody else in the industry wants to see more American drones. DJI is great because they create a great product, but would you be sad if it was a different brand that created the same thing? No, I wouldn't be. I
want to see more drones regardless.
Yeah.
And I want to see more competition. I don't even know if you can find any other market where it's so out of whack, like the drone market, where there's one company that dominates everything and everybody the way that DJI dominates the drone industry.
Yeah, we talked about that.
I don't think it's good for DJI. You could argue it makes them lazy. Now, I haven't really seen that because DJI is its own biggest competitor in many ways. I mean, the speed at which they introduce new versions of their products is pretty much insane.
Yep.
They don't have to do it because nobody makes them do it. There's no real competition.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if there would be another big player, it'd be better for DJI. It'd be better for us, for all of us in the drone industry.
Yep.
The one thing about Blue SUES that I found interesting is it all comes from the Department of Defense, right? Mm-hmm. Those strict regulations. Now you have companies that actually are approved. And what you see happening is that larger enterprises and larger corporations say, okay, we want drones that are also dealing with the information in a very secure way. We're going to take that same requirement. We're going to say we only want to buy Blue SUES drones.
Mm-hmm.
So you see that it's not just a government thing anymore. It now starts to spread out into businesses. And I think if that trend keeps going, and it seems like it will, it may become its own little ecosystem, if you will. And it doesn't seem like DJI is ever going to be able to be part of that, because I think partially it's targeted towards DJI or against DJI. Those are some interesting developments for sure.
I agree. And then there's one company we haven't talked about that was kind of front and center when you get into the hall, which was Axon with their DFR technology. And interestingly, they were the only DFR player out there. We know there is more.
Yeah.
I think that may have been by design, but I'm not sure. And then Axon Air, which is their
That's their new division, right?
Yeah, well, it's a software that's designed by DroneSense. So DroneSense was out there talking as well. They created their DFR system, which I think is remarkable, quite frankly, what they're able to do with. It's an AirBoss, if you've ever heard that term. It's an AirBoss software that kind of controls all the drones in the area and allows to create a feed, a video feed of all the drones in the area and send them to the right people. You know, this when you have an operation from a public safety perspective, whether it's police or fire, they have to be able to send that information to the people on the ground. And so you have the command center that gets all that data. Yeah. And then they've designed this thing to collect all the footage and be able to send it live to all the people. And it's critical, obviously, to...
It's cool that you bring this up, because a couple of years ago, this was the DJI AirWorks convention in Los Angeles. Romeo Dersher explained how during the Paradise fire, he actually was on the ground working with first responders. They used drones and they had a whole number of them, like a whole group of drone pilots flying drones, basically mapping the area and assessing the damage. So they would fly drones over neighborhoods. They would match it up with all their Google Maps, and then not only would they like name the streets, so you would know what streets you're on because everything is burned to the ground. What he told me, that all these drones have SD cards. So you take aerial photos, the photos then end up on the SD cards. Now they're stuck on that stupid card. So then the people had to come back to the office, offload the photos from the SD cards, upload them, create those maps, which takes forever. And then maybe after so many hours or a day later, you would actually have an updated map of a certain area. So now you know what the damage is and where you want to send your crews to. The ability to be able to collect that data on the drone, but then also start processing it right away and get that information to the people who need it out in the field on their phone is a huge development. And that's something we're seeing right now, is that the time from taking that photo with the drone to actually getting the information on the phone of, let's say, a fireman who's in that area working and being able to use that data, that time span is now being shortened. And I think that's going to be a huge enabler in being able to have first responders work faster, more effectively, and in many cases be able to save people's lives.
And with DFR, that's taking that to the next level with instant notification, instant information. Yeah. It kind of goes back to everything we talked about in the show so far, which is drone in a box, right? Beyond visual line of sight. And then have the ability to provide that data live to the user so they can make a decision. Every customer that we talk to of ours that is in the police department that is talking about DFR, they said this is the next big thing. This is
the technology is there nowadays.
And it's there. And flying a drone from anywhere you want, right? Like we did with Paladin, and flying the drone from right here, actually. I was sitting right
that was
here flying a drone in Texas.
Yeah. And so we spoke to Kyle Norforce about this as well. And he's like, especially, so they operate in Weber County in Utah, and it's a very hilly, mountainous environment.
Yep.
And sometimes if you start a drone flight from one location, you can fly to the top of a mountain, but you can't really go into that next valley because, one, you might lose the transmission signal. Two, you're not allowed to fly beyond visual line of sight. So what they would do is they send somebody else out, either on a motorcycle or even on a horse or by foot, get them positioned on that mountaintop, and then take over control of that drone and be able to keep flying, and then they have batteries with them, and it makes their missions more effective. And
to me, it makes no sense that they would have to do that. There's got to be a possible waiver to do that. It's just so narrow-minded in my mind.
It's like, what's the worst that could happen versus we need to save that person before it gets dark and cold.
So I was driving. I drove to Vegas, right? And you did the drive back with me, 4.5 hour drive in the middle of the desert, right?
Nothing there.
There's nothing there, right? Yeah. And I brought drones because I was like, well, maybe I can stop at one of these rest areas and go film some of these mountains. And then I was thinking about the whole visual line of sight thing. And there's a mountain far in the distance that I don't think I can get there with my car. And how dangerous would it be for me to go fly from here all the way to that mountain by staying at about 200 feet? The mountain in itself is probably 1,000 feet tall, at least, from what I can tell from the distance. Who is going to be flying with me at 200 feet in that area?
Yeah, probably nobody. But
no one.
But yeah, but this comes down to, are you a responsible and safe drone pilot?
Yeah.
And let's say in your case, you are. We also know other stories, and not naming names, but there are certain cities on the East Coast where People use drones in different ways, and they fly in beyond visual line of sight, and they fly them in areas where they shoot it.
And that's a different application.
It comes down to pilot responsibility.
It does. But to me, like, you know, if I'm in the middle of nowhere here, what is the risk? I have actually full view of everything around.
Yeah.
Like I can see, except for that mountain that's sitting right there in the back. And so there's got to be a different mentality when it comes to BV loss, and especially for first responders.
For sure.
You know, if you think about how limiting it is, think about, you know, we have forest fires here, and you see the landscape that we have around. We have tall trees, we have forest, and it's dry, and we have elevation, and we have people that get dropped off in the middle of these forest fires to go fight them.
Yeah.
What if they have a small drone that they can just put in a backpack so they can see on the other side? Sadly, several years ago, we lost 19 of these hotshots. They're called hotshots. There's very few of them in the country that do this job.
It's super dangerous.
And it's super dangerous. And they get surrounded by a fire not far from here in Yarnell. And they get surrounded by a fire and caught up to them and fortunately kill all of them.
Yeah. And wildfires travel really, really fast, maybe a lot faster than people realize.
They do. But if you think about it, like, could having a drone in their backpack that they can just send to see on top of the ridge to see that there was actually not far from it, they were very close to the command center, but they didn't know that. And they just couldn't get there because communication wasn't working. They didn't have all the information to make their decision. And this could have been life-changing for 19 people that, you know, are fighting forest fires. So, I think about this. And then I also think about, what if these guys have the thing in the backpack and they have to go fly on the other side of the ridge? Okay.
Yeah.
That's BV loss, right?
Yeah.
Because they can't see the thing. So technically they wouldn't even be allowed to do this. Yeah. Now, obviously, they would do it to save their life, right?
That's
the other thing. But from a regulation perspective, it doesn't make any sense. And the same thing with a firefighter that's on the ground trying to see what's on the other side of this building, and they have to put the drone on the other side of the building to see it. They lose visual line of sight. That's not BV loss.
No, it's not.
That's not BV loss.
But
it's treated as BV loss.
Yeah,
right?
But we've run into this problem time and time again, where we have one set of drone rules coming from the FAA for every use case.
Yep.
And it doesn't make sense. There's a big difference whether you have, let's say, a large Amazon drone, if that ever happens, to fly a whole bunch of packages to people, or even if they fly from one warehouse to another warehouse. Like, that's a very different mission than, let's say, somebody who makes their own FPV drone and then flies in a local park among the trees.
Yep.
Like, those are not the same kind of flights. They don't have the same kind of risk profile, yet they both have a remote ID requirement soon.
Yep.
And therefore, the guy with the FPV drone needs to figure out how to make his drone compliant with remote ID versus the Amazon drone that needs to live up to the same standards. And that problem is not just remote ID, it's BVLOS as well.
Yep.
And I think...
And other Part 107 rules, quite frankly.
Yeah, and I think this has been the issue with the FAA in the past, is that their DAC committee, the Drone Advisory Committee, one, didn't have enough drone pilots on that committee, so people with
still
actual...
Still not,
with actual hands-on experience. And that doesn't mean like just one person who flies drones. No, you need people from different use cases. You need people from the FPV community. You need people who use drones for inspections. You need people that do drones for delivery purposes. Mm-hmm. Like, you need these different use cases, and then you need to figure out, how do we make rules that match up and work for those different risk profiles and use cases with drones? And
yep.
I think we're a long way away from that, but I think that's what needs to happen in order to allow the drone industry to kind of really explode.
There's two drone pilots on that committee out of 50 people.
Vic
and Kenji.
Those are awesome.
The only two people.
We're happy to have them on the committee, but it's not enough.
Of course, but
it's not enough.
Yeah, it's sometimes insulting from the FAA to have these people on these committees that have the C-level you know, titles, and that's all they've contributed to aviation ever.
Well,
they just stumble on aviation and they have no idea what's going on.
Yeah, they come from the manned aviation worlds. And
some of them don't even come from that at all.
Yeah.
I would welcome that. I would love to have people in there with manned aviation background, because they could bring the history, but half of these people are just not that at all, not even close.
All right, so I want to switch gears a little bit. One of the people I ran into at DJI Airworks was Olivier, and he is French. He works for DJI in Europe, and he basically deals with the media there. I don't work with him frequently, but I've met him in the past. It was good to catch up. One of the biggest drone stories that came out of France in the last couple of years was the fire of the Notre Dame, which is like a massive cathedral in the center of Paris. It's probably what the biggest, most famous monument in France, I would think.
Probably in the world, like the pride, I would say.
It's like the pride of the country, the pride of the city. The cathedral caught on fire, and this, I think, was April 2019.
Yep.
The whole roof structure is made of wood, basically. And that wood is so old and so dry that once it catches on fire, that fire spread like crazy. And before you knew it, the whole roof was on fire. The ladders from the fire trucks don't reach high enough to actually get to the point where they can, one, see what's going on and how it's spreading, or two, actually put water on it and try to fight the fire. So what they had to do is they had to send people into the building. It's an old structure. We don't build buildings the same way anymore because mm-hmm. it's not safe in these kind of environments when it's burning. So they had to send firemen into the building to try and save this monument. And the first time I read about it was an article in the New York Times where it was acknowledged that the fact that they had a drone flying around that building and seeing how the fire was moving and how it was spreading through the structure allowed the command or the chief in command to send the firemen to the right spots and prevent the fire from actually reaching the towers. Later on, they realized that if the drone hadn't been there, they would not have sent the people, the firemen, to the same spot, and probably one, maybe two of those towers would have collapsed. So you probably would have lost lives in that process. Mm-hmm. Two, you would have lost a good chunk of that monument. And the story of how the drone basically saved the Notre Dame is like the biggest, most illustrative story of how drones can make a difference. Mm-hmm. And he used it a lot. He showed me videos, photos of what happened. We're trying to get some of those people that were involved in those drone operations to actually come on the Pixel show and talk in detail about what went down. It'd be amazing. But I think in order to explain to the regular people that might not know much about drones what the value is of these devices and how we can use them, this is like one of the best stories out mm-hmm. there where the drone basically saved the cathedral.
Yeah, that's insane.
Yeah, so it was good to catch up with him and talk about that. And we're going to try to get him on the show. We're going to try to get the people from who actually flew the drone on the show. And so not only did they use drones to monitor that fire. Once the fire was put out, they actually had drones flying inside the cathedral where people, human beings, weren't able to get in.
Safely.
Mm-hmm. Because it was just simply too dangerous.
Yep.
But you can fly a Phantom in there, and that's exactly what they did. They flew a Phantom in there and basically looked at all the structures from the inside and identify what was safe, what wasn't, mm-hmm. and what the extent of the damage was.
Yeah, and then from the top too, there's a lot of footage from the top showing all
that. And then you make a 3D model, mm-hmm. and you can identify exactly what needs to happen next.
Yeah. We'll see a lot more of this in the future as we go. And then also, you know, we talk about drones a lot, but there is ground robots as well that are coming up, you know, with Boston Dynamics. And you start to see the two topics kind of meld together, you know, using a dock to put a drone on the back of it to use as a platform and you can take off once you're inside, or using the dock to have a LiDAR unit on top of it to go around. Every trade show I've been to in the last year and a half has had Spot, the dog, there, just displayed with some kind of sensor on it. I think it's just pretty cool.
We should get Brandon Schulman. Brandon Schulman used to work for DJI, moved to Boston Dynamics. We should get him back on the show and
we
talk
should get
about
him
that.
To give us a tour of the facility.
We should go to Boston. There you go.
We should do a live show from there. I think I like that.
But that's the whole point of doing the Pixel Drone Show, right? We want to talk to the people that are hands-on with drones and use drones in new and innovative and interesting ways and mm-hmm. get them on the show to get these stories out there. Because still, I mean, when I talk to people that are outside of the drone industry, by now most people know what drones are because everybody has a niece or nephew flying a drone that they got for Christmas. Mm-hmm. What they don't know is how drones can transport organs from one hospital to the other, or blood samples, or how, for instance, Zipline is using drones to bring medication and blood samples to remote locations where it might take 6 hours by car, if mm-hmm. you can even get there, depending on the raining season. In a drone, you get there in 40 minutes. Those are the kind of stories, and those are the kind of people we want to talk to on the Pixel Show to get those stories out there.
Yep. And I tell you what, this is probably a great way to end it. I think we've been talking for a while. I don't want to take too much time from our viewers, but this has been awesome. We talked for what, 4 hours, 5 hours yesterday on the drive back, and then talk another hour and a half on all this stuff.
This is what we do, right?
Well, after having written so many drone stories, I mean, this is the stuff that I get passionate about as well.
Yeah.
To share these stories. So, and I know you do too. And let's keep this going.
I agree.
Thank everybody for watching, and we'll be back with the Pixel Show shortly, I guess.
All right. Well, the next one will be on Tuesday, as always. And then we will let you know what the topic is going to be. I know what it is, but I don't want to talk about it.
It's not going to be Dragonfly.
It's not Dragonfly, that's for sure. All right. See you guys later.